Welcome back. Will you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Our speaker is being recorded tonight with her permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Kimberly from Long Beach.
Good evening. My name is Kimberly and I am an alcoholic. Can I see? No, I can't see. That's okay. That's better. Yay. Now I can see you guys.
Not the way to do it.
Not the way to do it.
Right the way it was.
Okay. As I said, my name is Kimberly and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Marcia for inviting us down. Thank Kendra for driving. Happy birthday to all the birthday people. Congratulations and welcome to the new people. I'm going to share with you a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened for me, and what I try to be like today as the result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Give you my statistics. My sobriety date is November 18th of 1989. My home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, and I have a sponsor in that group, Barbara F., who spoke here a couple weeks back. I saw the weirdest thing today. I got to tell you about this because we were obsessing about it. We got down here a little early, and we went to have something to eat at the Caro's, and this guy was kind of flirting with the waitresses and stuff, and we got up to pay our check. We thought, this guy's having an awfully good time. We got up to pay our check, and we saw that he was leaving, and he left a half a glass of wine on the table. We obsessed about that all afternoon. What a waste. I was like, oh, just drink it. Anyway, I'm originally from the Midwest, which I would have told you was a good reason to have a drink. I'm the middle child of three girls, which I would have told you was a good reason to have a drink. And I come from a very, very, very large Catholic family, which I would have told you was a great reason to belt some back, I'm telling you. You know, and there was always alcohol around when I was growing up in this large Catholic family. People were always getting married, having babies, or getting divorced. They had parties for that, too, sometimes. And I would be with my cousins crawling underneath the tables while the grown-ups were on the dance floor or chatting or whatever. And we'd be doing this number, you know, tasting some of that champagne punch. And sometimes we'd get a little woozy and lay down. But, you know, nothing really big. But my grandparents on my mother's side used to have these pinochle parties. And at these pinochle parties, they would get out these little tiny glasses. And they would get out this big bottle of amber liquid. And they would pour some in these little tiny glasses. And then they would sip on those glasses all night. And that would drive me crazy, like that glass of wine sitting on that table. It would be like, just drank it already. Well, I would notice that when the amber liquid got lower in the glasses, or if somebody happened to have two, they would laugh a little louder. They would talk a little louder. They seemed to be having a better time. And so my sister and I decide we're going to find out what this stuff is. So we get in the closet and unscrew that cap, and it takes two of us to lift that big gallon bottle of what I now know as Kessler's whiskey. And we pour some in the cap. Now, my sister puts her finger in, puts it on her tongue, and goes, eh. She don't want any more of that. Now, up to this point, I had never seen anyone do a shot. Like I said, they sipped on those little shot glasses. But I took that cap and shot it right back. Now, I'm not saying it goes down smooth and stays down smooth when you're like six. I coughed, I spit, I probably puked. But I remember it like it was yesterday. My hand shot right back out there. Let's try this again. Now, I'm not saying I became a daily drinker. It's hard to get liquor in kindergarten. Well, I don't know about nowadays. They're coming in younger and younger. But, you know, you file that away for future reference. And I'm the weird kid growing up. I'm the kid that's bouncing off the walls. I'm the kid that can't pay attention in class. I'm the kid that's messing with the train on the windowsill when I'm supposed to be quiet in reading circle. I don't care about reading circle. I don't want to hear that stupid book. My sister reads me that book at home. I could care less. And I'm already comparing your outsides to my insides. Oh, look, there's Marcia. She's got that dress I wanted. I hate her. Oh, look, there's Tommy. He got those tennis shoes I wanted. I hate him, too. You know, and here you are sitting, being good, doing what you're supposed to be doing, listening to teacher. And I can't stand it anymore, and I got to poke you. Now, when I poked you, I got sent to the cloakroom. That was my first resentment in kindergarten. After a while, though, I found I like to get sent to the cloakroom, you see, because your stuff is in there. And I could try on your little coats and your little shoes, and go through your pockets and your lunch boxes. And, you know, you might have treats in there, little toys. And I know you brought them for me because you knew at some point during the day I was going to end up in there. So I would steal your stuff in kindergarten. So I just go through school being weird. Now, somewhere right around about junior high school, my friends and I started to be able to babysit at night. And I don't know where we got the idea, but there were like eight of us that hung together. And we would find out who was babysitting where on the Friday or Saturday night, who could cop the bottle or steal the bottle from where. And then the rest of us would show up over there, and we'd pass this bottle around eight girls. Now, I don't ever remember getting tipsy or drunk or whatever. I remember it feeling warm inside. It would hit my stomach, and that spring that was just a little bit too tight inside would just loosen up just a little bit. And I'd be like, ah, and I could breathe a little bit. Well, I stayed out of trouble in junior high school for a little bit. And then I got into high school, and I found my people. And my people were having a hairy buffalo party. Now, if you don't know what a hairy buffalo party is, I'll give you the recipe. Back when the garbage cans used to be made out of aluminum, you go to the hardware store, you get a brand new one, you bring it home, you scrub it out, sterilize it as best you can, rinse it out with the garbage garden hose, goes at the front door of your party. You get a keg for the lightweights. You have a BYOB party. Whatever comes through that door that's not beer gets dumped in that trash can and mixed with Hawaiian punch, and that's what you drink all night. Now, the reason it's called the hairy buffalo is because they say if you drink one, you think you hear the buffalo. If you drink two, you think you see the buffalo. If you drink three or more, you think you are the buffalo. Now, I drank a lot of this stuff. A lot. Now, the thing about hairy buffalo punch and Kimberly is when you mix Kimberly with hairy buffalo punch, my clothes come off. Now, this is bad in itself when you're like 15 or 16 to be rescued off of people's front porches or the top of someone's car one time, walking down the street, taking your clothes off. You see, because at this time I was taking some dance classes, I was taking some belly dancing classes, and I felt the need to show you my belly dancing skills when I had the hairy buffalo punch. And you know, I get like Lucy on the Vitamita Vegemite commercial. Don't you know it's hot in here? And I got to start taking some stuff off. And I don't care. Now, like I said, this is bad in itself when you're like 15 or 16, but you see this large Catholic family I have has sort of an unwritten tradition that one child every generation is groomed to enter the clergy. Guess who they picked? Now, I have two aunts that are Ursuline nuns in Canada. So they were grooming me to be the nun because I was the one they didn't know what to do with. Before they called it ADD or ADHD or whatever they're calling it these days, they used to just call us hyperactive or incorrigible. And what that meant is I couldn't sit still for 5 minutes in my own skin. And, it, you know, many a report card would come home. Kimberly is a bright child, so much potential if only she wasn't so incorrigible. So I had that going on. So I'm drinking the Hairy Buffalo Punch, and in school, I don't know why this is bugging me, I'm getting pretty good grades, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and after school, I'm going to religious education and things, and on the weekends, I'm going to the Hairy Buffalo party and taking my clothes off on your mother's kitchen table. So I'm already leading a double life in high school. And I get through high school somehow, and I graduated in June of 84, and spent that summer running around to parties. Incidentally, during that time, I got popped for DUI on a bicycle riding home from a 4th of July party. I don't know, those streets are just too narrow, and that cop car shouldn't have been parked there. They don't like it when you fly up on the roof of their car. But anyway, so in August of 1984, I went to live at the Ursuline Convent in Maumee, Ohio. And now I hear a lot of nuns and priests share from the podium how they got drunk or they got liquor at the rectory or the convent. I got ripped. I was at a dry convent. The only liquor, any alcohol on campus was way on the other side locked up in the rectory for sacrament. But we're resourceful people. We get what we need to get when we need to get it. Now, postulates, candidates for religious order, have to go everywhere in twos. I didn't know how to drive, but if you've got the keys to the station wagon, I'm going with. And I got my bottles. Now, through an inventory with my current sponsor, I had asked her, Barbara, I didn't have any money. I never knew where I was getting these bottles of wine from. And she said, you were probably stealing it. And I said, well, I never got busted. And she said, Kimberly, who's going to stop a nun? Like, take it, sister. You probably need it. So, incidentally, one bottle of wine will fit nicely down those deep pockets of your frock. The trick is to walk down the hall and not have it clink on your crucifix. But I was drunk a lot in my room. Incidentally, rooms at the convent are called cells. You figure it out. But I was drunk a lot in my room. I was drunk a lot in morning meditation. I was drunk a lot in morning reflection. I was drunk a lot in morning lesson. I was drunk a lot in morning mass. I was drunk a lot in Sunday mass. I was drunk a lot in evening reflection. I was drunk a lot in evening prayer. I was drunk a lot at dinner. I was drunk a lot. Now, the Catholic Church had sent me to nursing school. I had wanted to be a doctor. They said nurses or nuns cannot be doctors. You can be a nurse. Our order is either nurses or teachers. Pick one. My first resentment at them. So they had sent me to nursing school, and my first class was at 7:45 in the morning, and my last class got out at 7:45 at night. And I was drunk a lot on campus, too. I took exams and blackouts. I took clinicals and half in the bag. I was often mostly intoxicated in lecture. And as I said, my first class was at 7:45 in the morning, and my last class got out at 7 o'clock at night. And it's dark in Ohio at 7:45 in the morning and at 7 o'clock at night. Now, it's really embarrassing to come to when you're walking across campus and you don't know if it's day or night, and you have to ask somebody. You look at your watch, it says 7 o'clock, and I didn't know. Was I on my way to my first class, or did I just get out of my last class? And so I go through nursing school, and I live at that convent for a year. Now, what happens after a year at the convent is what comes time for public reception. And what happens at public reception is you sit before the archdiocese of your parish and all the nuns of your order, your entire family, and everyone who has known you your entire religious life. And you tell them all the reasons you feel God's calling. I wasn't feeling it, folks. You know, my only reasons, you know, I saw how my two aunts lived. They never had to worry about what they were going to do for a living, who was going to clothe them, who was going to feed them, where they were going to live. And my thought was, if I go ahead and become a nun, I will never have to take responsibility for my own life. That's as noble as my intentions were. So what they did was they made a mistake because they let you go home for a week before public reception. I can't tell you who I was with or where I was. I was probably drunk. And I showed up that Sunday morning for high mass with the biggest hangover I had ever had in my life up to that point. As my friend Ann W. likes to say, I was knee-walking, snot-flinging sick. And I'm hiding in the ladies' room. Now, my friend Jessica showed up, and she said, here, a little bit of the hair of the dog that bit you. And she produces this bottle. I believe it was Southern Comfort. And we proceed to drink in the ladies' room. And they have to come get me out of the ladies' room to sit before the bishop and answer my set of questions. I'm in a blackout. So what I'm about to tell you is what was told to me, is that I told them what they could do with their church and their vows and their God. And I came out of my blackout to see my little Irish Catholic grandmother's face. No one had to tell me what pitiful and incomprehensible the demoralization meant when I got here. You see, I was her angel. I was going to be her nun. And I took every hope and dream she ever had for me and threw it at her feet like it was garbage. Needless to say, I am not now, nor have I ever been, a fully frocked nun. Incidentally, I made amends to that church. I made verbal and financial amends to them. I made amends to my grandmother and to my family and to that Ursuline convent. And one of the biggest gifts that I got this past year was in July. I got to go back to that same church and take communion with my grandmother. Because last April, I was reinducted as a fully initiated member of the Catholic Church after 2 years of instruction. I continued to go to nursing school, and I took my final exams half in the bag. I absolutely do not remember taking state boards. I got my nursing license in the mail. I have pictures of a graduation I do not remember being at. I went to work for an in-home care service. I became a licensed hospice nurse, and I was responsible for terminally ill patients in their homes. And I was not a very good nurse. I was drunk a lot on the job. And I would come out of blackouts bathing patients, starting IVs, administering medication. I stole from these people. I stole their medication. I stole their alcohol, and I stole their trust. Incidentally, I developed a 2-year morphine habit as a nurse. A lot of my patients were end-stage cancer and AIDS patients. And I took that IV push morphine home with every intention of sticking that needle in my arm. And the thought, you know, those little moments of clarity that run across your brain like a rat, skittle, 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 skittle. If you stick the needle in your arm, you got a problem. And so what I did is I mixed Diet 7-Up and morphine cocktails and chased them with Michelob Light. I had lived with my sister for a little while after leaving the convent, but after a while she didn't want me living with her either because she didn't know what was wrong with me. She thought I was just crazy, and I would accuse her of trying to make me crazy because I would say, hey, you rearranged the furniture. You're trying to make me crazy. She said, no, you were doing that at 3:00 in the morning, because that's what I would do. I'd come home from work and rearrange the furniture. Now, don't ask me why I was rearranging the furniture. One time I came out of a blackout on my knees in front of the oven with my head in the oven. I don't know what I was doing there either. And one time I came to in front of the cupboard door with a steak knife in one hand. I don't know what I was doing there either. But anyway, so I'm working for this nursing service, and after a while, like I said, my sister doesn't want me living with her. So I'm living at the YWCA, because nobody else wants me living with them either. Kimberly's just too weird. We're not real sure what's wrong with her. She's just weird. And I'm living at the YWCA, and most of the people go to school or work during the day, and I work at night, and I like that just fine, because then you don't know what I'm really doing. And I would come to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, go down to that local bar, have a couple, get on the bus and go to work. Sometimes I might change my uniform, sometimes I might not. Sometimes I might wash the uniform, sometimes I might not. I'm not changing it, so I'm probably not washing it. And at this time, this is the mid-80s, and I'm making $14.50 to $24 an hour, working 8 to 10-hour shifts. My rent is $150 a month, no utilities. Like I said, I'm not buying new uniforms because I'm not washing the ones I got. I'm not maintaining my equipment. I'm not keeping up on that malpractice insurance. And I never have any money. And I'm more or less insanely drunk every day. Now, after a while, I'm living there and I'm running my thing. And I meet my dad for the first time in 22 years in 88. And he said, why don't you come to California? I've never been to California, sure. Came out here for 2 weeks on vacation, was drunk most of the time I was here. I remember going to Disneyland. I remember seeing the Spruce Goose. After that, it's a complete blank. I was asked, I don't know how many years back it is now, but I was asked to speak in Joshua Tree a few years back. And the speaker host had said, would you like to go through the monument? I said, sure, never been through the monument. Let's go. They took me places that I have pictures of my father and I standing. So I guess I had been there before. So I go back to Ohio, and I'm running my game for a while, and after a while, my father says to me, you know, we're screaming for nurses here in California. Why don't you come out here? If life gets too rough in Ohio, why don't you come to California? My butt was on the next plane leaving Toledo Express Airport. We call that a geographic for the Union people. I was drunk my first week here. I was drunk most of my first month here, and it occurred to me, my dad and my stepmother do not drink. No one else is buying the alcohol. I better get a job. But I can't go find out how to get that nursing license transferred, you see, because I got to drink. I can't find out how to go get those credits transferred because I got to drink. I can't even find out how to go get a job in the medical field here because I got to drink. So I get a job in a little clothing store as a manager. And I have to have that, you know, it looks like a legal cup of coffee, but what it really is half a commuter mug filled with whatever liquor I could reach from on my tiptoes from that high shelf above the sink with coffee splashed on top so you think I'm drinking coffee. Pop the lid on, go to work. Now, there's a little liquor store halfway to work. I got to go in there, grab a pack of cigarettes. And he used to have a bin with those little, I like to call them sample bottles. You know those things they give you on the airplane and try to tell you it's a drink? Used to be able to buy a handful of those for like $5. Throw some money at him. You see, I got to have those because that's how I got to get through my day. Got to go to that 7-Eleven next to work. Get equivalent of a big gulp. Pour most of it out. Dump all those little bottles in it. Goes underneath the cash register. And you see, I'm the manager. Don't touch. Don't come near my register. Don't touch my cup. I had those poor girls that worked for me thinking I was a germaphobe for a whole year. You know, and I'm going to that little club on the corner by where I live, not because I'm, you know, wanting to meet friends and have a good time. I'm not a party girl. You see, if I'm sitting by the dance floor and there's a glass of white Zin sitting there, I might dance with you. Don't touch me. If I'm sitting at the bar and there's a shot glass and a bottle of Jack sitting there, don't look at me, don't speak to me, and God help you if you touch me. You see, I have a friend. His name is Jack, and I certainly don't need you. And I'm drinking at you. And I'm drinking to make you all go away. And don't you know it's all your fault? Don't you know if you were nicer to Kimberly, she wouldn't drink like this? And don't you understand if life was as painful for you as it is for me, you'd have to drink too? Because by now I have to have some sort of alcohol in me to breathe in and out. Because life just hurts. And my world gets darker and smaller every day. And I hooked up with the local party favor dealer and I'm running that game for a while. And I get sick too sick from that. And I say, go to them and say, I don't want any more of that stuff. I'm going to clean it up. I'm going to act like a lady. We're going to get it together. And I switch from whiskey to white Zin. But you see, without that other stuff, I can't drink enough to shut my head off. And if I can't shut my head off, I can't go out there and live with you. So I'm drinking 4, 5, 6 bottles of white Zinfandel in the back of the closet with the dog. Because, you know, somehow I don't think Lady Diana had that on her resume. After a while, I can't live in the back of the closet anymore, so I go out there and I got to get some more of that stuff from that person. And I run that until November. November of 89 rolls around and I am sick. Sick, sick. And I go to that person one more time and I say, I don't want any more of you. I don't want any more of that stuff. We're going to get it together. We're going to clean it up. And I was promptly told, you don't understand. I own you. You see, I was selling myself to this person for drugs and alcohol. Now, my sponsor likes to remind those of us that she sponsors that alcoholism does not care where you came from. It does not care about your education. It doesn't care how much money you make or how many cars you have or what mommy and daddy did for a living. It will reduce you to a bum. You see, for me, I don't know how else to explain how this little girl with so much potential, who is candidate for religious order, was reduced to the equivalent of a $2 whore. Because I would sell myself to you for the next $2 glass of wine and not bat an eyelash. And piece by piece, drink by drink, I'm drinking away that integrity. I'm drinking away that accountability. I'm drinking away that lady my grandmother brought me up to be. That night, I was beaten, I was assaulted, and I was shot at. And I ran home to where every good little alcoholic goes. I ran home to mommy and daddy. And as I crossed the threshold of their house, I noticed that they had a friend of the family that was there that night, and she was dying of a terminal illness, and she's sitting there with her little oxygen tank, and my stepmother asked me if I wanted something to eat. Incidentally, my stepmother was part of a Team Rudden Memorial Coastview Adolescent Drug and Alcohol Unit, and every once in a while she'd ask me if I was tired or if I was done yet, and it would just go right over the top of my head. And this night she asked me if I wanted something to eat. I couldn't tell you the last time I had eaten, slept, bathed, combed my hair, looked in a mirror. And the thought of food on my stomach just gagged me. And as I walked through their living room, this woman that was dying said to my stepmother, Vicky, she looks like she's dying. And I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror, and what I saw resembled this crypt keeper. My hair was falling out, my teeth were loose, my eyes were sunken in, I could see every bone in the top half of my body, and I was bleeding from places healthy people don't bleed from. I blacked out and I passed out and I came to with my stepmother basically reviving me on their living room floor and my father running around screaming, help her, she's dying. They detoxed me for I don't know how long in their back bedroom. And the first clear day that I was able to sit up and not spit up, this woman came and she said, I'm going to take you someplace today where they're going to teach you that you don't have to live like you've been living if you don't want to. And she took me to the 7 a.m. attitude adjustment meeting at Marina Pacifica in Long Beach. That was my first home group. We were there 7 days a week at 7 a.m. I come from the school of sponsorship, where we thought the first step was shut up and get in the car. My first sponsor got off work at 6 o'clock in the morning. My butt better be on that corner no later than 6:30, or she was leaving me, and she better still see me in that meeting by 7 a.m. The people in those rooms spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous, step by step, tradition by tradition, principle by principle. They gave me back that integrity. They gave me back that accountability. I learned how to be that lady my grandmother had brought me up to be. I had the honor and privilege of learning the traditions from a pair of brothers named Frank and Bill. I stayed sober in that group for 6 months, and then my heart and other parts of my body took me to Oxnard. And in Oxnard, there's not a whole lot going on if you're a little white girl and you don't speak Spanish. I started going to school, and I found this meeting halfway in between where I was going to school and home. One day I was walking home, and I saw a circle and a triangle, so I went in to check it out. They had a literature meeting. And they met Monday through Friday at 12:30. I got out of school at 12, so it worked out great. They read every piece of literature that AA had out up to that point in Spanish. It was a Spanish-speaking meeting. I don't speak Spanish. But they let me come to their meeting. And they would sit in a big circle, and I would sit just on the outside of the circle, and somebody would sit next to me and interpret. They would make sure I had the literature in English. If somebody shared, they would interpret for me. If I shared, they would interpret back. And I was able to stay sober there for 18 months. And then I found myself back in Long Beach. That relationship ended, and I was living with my stepmother's mom for a little bit. And then they put her in a nursing home, and I got my own apartment. For the first time in my life, I lived by myself. And I called my first sponsor, and she was getting ready to move up north, and she said, you know, get a different home group. Get a new home group. Get a new sponsor. And when you get a new sponsor, find someone you can tell your secrets to or you will die. Find someone who's not going to turn into your lover, your mother, your higher power, or your best friend. But I didn't do that. I went to work, I came home, and I sat in that little apartment, and I didn't call AA people, and I didn't go to AA meetings, and I didn't read AA literature, and I didn't get an AA sponsor, and I didn't go to AA meetings, and I went absolutely out of my mind. And I would lay on that floor. I lived upstairs, and I had like big floor-to-ceiling windows, and I would lay on that floor and peek out under those blinds, and if your car alarm went off more than 2 times in a row, I'd call the police on you. If I was walking down the hall of my apartment and I could hear your TV, I'd call the police on you. If you were walking down my street and I had never seen you before, I would call the police on you. You know, when I was paranoid, because they're out there. I don't know who they are, but they're out there and they're going to get me. And one day, you know, I used to leave my landlady notes. Dear Jennifer, here's who I called the cops on last night. And one day she came by my apartment and she said, you're not doing too well, are you? She said, didn't you used to go to that A&A thing? I said, yeah. She said, well, you better go back there. You were doing pretty good when you were going to that A&A thing. She said, there's this girl that moved in downstairs. She goes to that A&A thing. Let's go talk to her. So we went downstairs and talked to Jennifer. Lori. Went downstairs and talked to Lori. And Lori took me to a meeting that was right out my back door and across the street. And Lori was taking a chip that night for 90 days, and her sponsor was speaking. Now, I heard this woman up there talk about being a drunk nurse. I had never heard anybody talk about being a drunk nurse before. So I asked her to be my sponsor. And she took me the rest of the way through the steps, because incidentally, this whole year that I was not going to a meeting, I was holding on to a 4-step that I hadn't shared with anybody. That'll make you crazy. She took me through the rest of the steps, and incidentally, Barbara is my 5th sponsor. I have always changed sponsors when either they moved, I moved, or I looked around and found that I was busier than my sponsor. You see, I have to have a sponsor I see in meetings. I have to have a sponsor that I see doing the do and doing the stuff, because I'm a sneaky liar. I don't bold-faced lie to you. I just don't tell you what's really going on. So if I'm not seeing you in meetings and calling you every day, you don't know what's really going on. Now, I'm a big one for service work. I've done a lot of service work over my 22 years. I've been on convention committees. I've been on other planning committees. I served on the Harbor Area Central Office Committee for 2 years. I had the privilege of serving in general service for 6.5 years. I started out as an alternate GSR, became the GSR, and then became the district committee member chair for District 2 in Area 9. And then my last commitment with General Service was my favorite commitment I've ever had. I was the Area 9 Grapevine Chair. And I got to go around to district meetings and home groups and talk about the grapevine and the history of this thing that saves my life on a daily basis. I learned so much. And I want to thank Eileen for sharing with us about the preamble. I love the preamble. It reminds me of how I'm supposed to be. I absolutely love the traditions. In some circles, I am known as the traditions Nazi. But I figure, you know what? If that's the worst people think of me in AA, I'll take that. I'll take that. Because as the founder of my group says sometimes, I would rather be despised for what I am than liked for what I am not. How much time do I have left?
About
10 minutes. Oh, wow. I'm doing good tonight. I have the privilege of sponsoring two ladies, and I get them in service work, too. If you're sponsored by me and you have at least 2 years of sobriety, you must have a service commitment outside your meetings. One of my sponsees has a panel at Long Beach Community Hospital, as I have a panel at Long Beach Community Hospital. That's my new service commitment. I am in H&I. And my other sponsee serves on the Harbor Area Central Office Committee. I try to be as active as I can. I have to keep busy. In 2007, like a lot of people, I was downsized right out of my company. And at this job, when I first started there, my anonymity had been blown because I was reading my big book, and I had the paperback one that, you know, that it's just blue on both sides. And I put it down on my stuff and went to the ladies' room. And when I came back, one of my coworkers had it. Now, he's a religious man, so I'm thinking he probably thought it was the Bible and was going to check it out. Well, the next day, everyone in the company knew I was an AA. Now, I have to tell you, this company had 8 full-time employees, including the doctor that owned the place. So it wasn't that horrendous. But I'm like thinking, oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, crap. But it ended up being a blessing in disguise because someone was able to come and ask me about their brother-in-law. And someone else was able to come and ask me about themselves. And I was able to refer to them to some pages in the big book and the one woman to Al-Anon. But when I was downsized out of my company, you know, I had this one person I worked with who happened to be my immediate supervisor. She was the department head, but there were only 2 of us in the department. You figure that out. But I had had problems with her, to be polite. And so when I went for my exit interview, while I was packing my desk and they were getting ready to exit interview me, I thought, this is it. I'm going to let this rinky-dink company know everything I think about them and their management skills and their. And then it occurred to me, all these people know that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they know how much time I have. Do I want possibly their one and only example as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is this fool who's ranting and raving and going off like an idiot? So I didn't tell them. I went into that interview and I conducted myself integrably. I can't say that word, with integrity. And incidentally, one of the last things they said to me was that of all the people that had worked at that company over the last 20 years up to 2007, that they had had to either let go or had left for one reason or another, that I was the most rehirable. That's a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because on the natch, I would have let them have it. On the natch, I would have been throwing charts at people. On the natch, I would have told that doctor off for his chauvinistic comments long ago. But you people taught me how to act differently. You people taught me how to take the principles I've learned in here and take them out there into my daily living. Because that's what I have to do. It's one thing to practice them in here with you. It's another to go out there and live them. And I have to act out there like I did at that company. Like everyone knows that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, even when they don't. I have to do the right thing, even when no one's looking. I have to be nickel and dime honest and more. I believe I'm almost out of time. Okay. I want to leave you with this. I like to close with this sometimes when I have the time. My first sponsor gave me this poem when I was brand new, and I like to close with it because it's a reminder to me also. It's called Broken Dreams, and it goes like this. As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. But then instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help in ways that were my own. At last I snatched them back and cried, "How can you be so slow?" "My child," he said, "what could I do? You never did let go. I would invite you to let go, let God, but let's hang on to one another and we'll all stay sober another 24 hours. I want to thank you for your hospitality. I can't speak tonight. Hospitality. I want to thank you for listening, for your invite, and thank you for my life.